accession number 19587, reel 3.
Peter Davey, reel 3. You were just telling me about the North Korean infiltrator.
Yes, we awoke, or was in the company lines, and there was this North Korean fellow stood in, and nobody had taken any notice of him until somebody had said, "Well, I don't recognise this, who is he?" And apparently it was a North Korean soldier that had come through the lines. How he got through, nobody knows, because having been on the entrance to the barbed wire fencing, I've done that particular job where we counted in the patrol, number of patrol. We always counted out the patrols, and incidentally, nobody ever sent out 13 people. It would probably be 12 or 15 or 16. So what used to happen was that the North Koreans who wanted to defect would tag on to the end of a patrol coming in. If they had not been counted in, that is the only way in which I think that particular North Korean soldier could have got to the lines. When he'd got to the trenches, people had dispersed and he was just stood there, and people assumed that he was a porter.
Did he want to surrender?
Oh, yes. Yeah, he was quite harmless. The listening patrols was one of the things that went out. The recce patrols, lots of these, the snatch patrols and fighting patrols and all that. Lots of it was done at night, but the war was a very funny situation there, where the tactics had changed from where the Americans were nearly pushed off at Pusan. I mean, through the injection of the equipment that had been brought in. So in a forward position like that, one could see what was going on by your supporting regiments. The Norfolks were on our right, and the Black Watch was on our left. During the daytime, the Vickers machine guns of our own company would sight and zero their guns on fixed lines, so that when there was movement on the forward positions or noise, the Vickers machine guns would then open up, having known exactly where their traversing was going. And this can be quite a horrendous noise, as having been in that position, watching the Vickers machine guns, which incidentally were so similar to my father's machine gun, who was in the 1914-18 war, hence the interest in that particular aspect, that the traversing was done. And I believe there was quite a number of casualties to the Korean army through thinking that they were able to walk through over the hills, and with machine gunners could pick at liberty which particular hill they wanted. The other part of the observation that one would have during the day was the watching of the aircraft. There was one little spotter plane. I used to think that fella, it was so slow and could be picked off by small arms fire. He would just fly up the valley very quietly, looking around to see what was going on. And also, I'm not quite sure here of the type of plane, but I believe they were Sea Furies, of dropping napalm bombs on the North Korean situations. But this to a certain extent, was gratifying, but it was also horrendous to see a napalm bomb hit midway up a hill, bounce in, and then spread its load all over the hill. Now, as the Chinese employed an army of villagers, or there was two types. There was the Republican, the volunteers of the North Koreans. Their sole job was to bring up supplies and dig trenches. Now, some of these trenches, as in later years, the same method was used in Vietnam, the trenches would go some miles underground. And your grenades, don't matter whether they're phosphorus grenades, Mills grenades, flamethrowers, even atomic bombs, could not reach that particular group of men because they were so far underground. But it was horrendous to watch an attack, but gratifying, if you know what I mean. The creeping barrage, again, having been in front, or rather behind a creeping barrage, one kept advancing, getting close to that creeping, if it didn't creep fast enough, up the hill, softening up the positions of the North Koreans. So that, again, was something that passed through your mind. I hope that the creeping barrages creeps a bit faster until it went over the crest of the hill and over, and then we took up that position on top of Baldy, or whatever section you were in with what job you were allocated. I've seen lots of people do silly things. I can remember two fellows that I joined up with. One was a Private Moore from Torquay, and one was a Private Lansdowne, Hampshire Regiment. Can't tell you his location. But one Moore was an ex-convict who'd just recently come out of prison, and Lansdowne was an only boy, and yet they had an affinity between the two. What it was, I don't know, but Private Lansdowne was out on patrol one day, and the last we saw of him was being taken up the hill by the Chinese. Private Moore was in deep shock and could not do much about it, and came back, but volunteered for every type of patrol that was going every day, logically trying to think that he could do something for his friend Lansdowne. But wisdom is something great to have, but foolhardiness is something stupid. And he stood up and he just wanted to take on the whole of the North Korean army, and I'm afraid he got wounded. He was flown out by helicopter, and he died of his wounds on the way to the base hospital. And the helicopters that they were using them, the stretchers were either side of the helicopter. So I'm afraid Private Moore and both Private Lansdowne had lost their life. Fireflies at night, that was a funny sort of thing. When being on stag duty in the dead of night, one would look down and think down in amongst those fences of barbed wire before you, there was lights going on, but in actual fact it was fireflies. Quite frightening at sometimes, because you thought it was lights coming towards you. The wildlife in Korea was quite interesting as well. There was beautiful butterflies there with a wingspan of some 6 inches. Very slow flying. There was magpies. One instance that was that I remember quite vividly, and it was the my OP post where I had a panoramic view pad of the hills, whereby the job was to locate the direction and take a bearing on the direction of the armaments that were being used against us, document where, what position they fell on, try to assignate as to what type of weapon it was, and generally phone up the commander, and he would in turn bring down a barrage if it was a section of Chinese or whatever strength it was, whereby they could use, where we are, use the word stonking, which in them days, a hill had a stonking by your tanks or by your... And this particular day when I was on observation post, this mortar didn't sound right to me. It was pushing air directly in front, and I knew damn well that that thing was headed for the OP post. So I did no more than get down. It hit about somewhere in the region of 3, maybe 4 yards in front of me, but it blew off the parapet of my OP, my panoramic view of the foreground. When I got up, lo and behold, curled underneath that panoramic view was a copperhead snake, which would be as big around about 1/2 inch round, but it was one of the most deadliest snakes in Korea. And my officer hit it on the ground and shot it. It didn't want shooting, but anyway, he then decided to give it an autopsy. After it was dead, he showed me its fangs, he showed me where the venom would come from. He chopped its head off and he slit it down with a razor blade and put it out on a piece of board, and it dried out in the sun. One of those silly little things that happens in warfare. There's also the other, the sad side of warfare as well. And not everybody has got such a strong will, and some of us are weaker than others, and some will collapse under strain. And I had actually been involved in an NCO and cowardice, which probably lots of people wouldn't think that there such a thing could happen. This was no way a syndrome of shell shock or anything like this. This was pure cowardice whilst going down the main gully. This fellow was, who I will not name, but I can assure you it did happen. He attempted to shoot himself through the foot and missed the first time. I was on OP and phoned up and said, you know, there's some activity in the gully leading to our battalion positions, and was informed that there was a patrol going out, and it was not to worry about, as it was a false alarm. Within 5 to 10 minutes later, another shot rang out. Again, I phoned headquarters, and they said, no, it was just an accident. And the third time, I heard a voice say, me dancing foot, I'll never dance again. As plain as that. Because it does, at night time, the sound did carry up the gully. If this particular NCO had shot himself through the foot, intended, I termed it as cowardice, he was whipped off to a army hospital and flown out to Japan. And within 6 weeks, he was back again in line, obviously with no tapes on his arm. But that was one particular case. Another one, I accidentally forgot there was a round in my gun, and I was cleaning the end, and I shot my trigger finger. Two cases of cowardice. delayed cowardice rather than cowardice in the face of action. So,
but was that second instance to the same man?
No, two different people.
Was that, were conditions so bad that they prompted that type of thing?
No, because there were weeks that went by that no activity was ever seen, but not even a Chinaman was seen, or North Korean, whichever you like. So, you've had your Christmases and you've had your toilet. Funny thing, there was a toilet, and it was reinforcement angle iron stakes that had three sides to it, had machine gun belts that were interwoven on the two sides and the back, a piece of wood with a hole in the ground, no door, obviously, but you had a panoramic view while sat on there of your battalion lines. This was incidentally on the lee side of that forward position. And I did use that and laugh. We had church services. One church service, church service that I remember whilst I was in reserve position was we were halfway through. And we got mortared. Obviously, the church service was brought to a quick end. Whilst we were in the battalion position now, there were supplies that had to come up from the valley or the road that brought our supplies in the echelons. A fellow named Sully, who came from Devon, Tavistock, Devon, had an idea. I believe it was his idea, but they managed to get hold of a jeep, and in working order, and they put it on upon blocks. They were able to obtain a hawsers, a long hawser, and a trailer of this jeep, and they connected the trailer up to the hawser, which in turn went round the wheels without the tires on of the jeep, and they were able to transport all our supplies up to the hill, which saved a tremendous amount of labour, like water, ammunition and all that, which was a brilliant idea. Right, we didn't. We went into a reserve position after several weeks, and there were showers, and we thought that was brilliant. But during the day, what we had or were delegated to do was to go digging on a range of hills called the Kansas Line. Now, the Kansas Line was the second line of defense if in the event that our particular lines was overrun, and we would then retreat to this Kansas Line. So the Kansas Line involved the hill that the glorious Gloucesters were surrounded on. And I did visit that particular location, and then quite a lot of digging and barbed wiring and things like that. So that was the reason, that was the job whilst out of the active line in reserve company. Unfortunately, when I came out of being from the forward position, so the battalion lines into reserve, I contracted yellow jaundice, hepatitis, and this was caught up by the REMC corporal, who was very observant, in as much that I had been perspiring quite a lot, and I sort of wiped my forehead on the sleeve and it dried white, and I had been taking my salt tablets, but he said, you have a liver complaint whereby you're jaundiced, and I'm afraid that your days are finished here, because you've got less time left than what it is for, because by that time, the following July, I think it was, because we went into the line just prior to Christmas, 1950, and I contracted the yellow jaundice round about August, September of 51. And then I was flown, or rather, went to base hospital, and they took me to an airfield, and they flew me in a Dakota to Cure, or Sasebo, I think it was Sasebo. And then I went to a hospital in Cure. And by the time I had, because it was only rest that could do anything, by the time I had become well enough to travel, I was within 3 to 4 weeks of embarking on the ship, which took 6 weeks to get home anyway, because we came back on, forget the name of the ship now, Fowey, I think it was the Fowey. So I'd had something like about 6 to 8 weeks in hospital, and then 6 weeks prior to being departing or being demobbed. I was demobbed December the 4th or 1952. But this jaundice, I believe, was caught through eating. I had a bar of chocolate whilst I was in the trench, and I'd broken it off, and because I'd seen the rats had gnawed the one end of it, so I thought if I break it off in half and throw that away, the other, but no. The MO seemed to think that I contracted, I've picked up this disease through the rats. They called them blue rats. Don't know why, but they were bluish twins. So, really, the travelling backwards and forwards to the Kansas line was the thing that was done in reserve. Whilst I was in that hospital, a pal of mine by the name of Ray Beer, you can't forget a name like that, can you? He came into the hospital, but not my ward. And one of the nurses there mentioned that there was a man came in from the Welsh Regiment. There were several people from the Welsh Regiment there, but this particular man, he was a local boy from me in Swindon. He said there was a fella came in, and I did go over. I was getting better by this time, and I went to see him. And believe it or not, in training they always told you to keep your bum down, which he did, but in handing over to Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry, he was showing them down the gully, and the fellow from the Canadian Light Infantry had a Sten gun that went, it was cocked but not on safety, went off, and the bullet went through the top of his right bullet buttock, came out just under his scrotum, and glanced off onto his forward leg as he was walking. And he laughed about it, but I don't think he laughed at the time. There were, in the rear echelons, there were entertainers that came to the Korean War. There were films being shown. British and American entertainers. There was quite a a relaxed attitude when one came out of forward positions and battalion positions and reserve positions. And the food was very nice as well. And during that period that we were in reserve position, we were allowed to go swimming in the River Imjin, which most people will know was a very wide river. As the army did not issue swimming trunks, and it was that time of the year when the sun was very, very hot, one can imagine what 200 naked men looked like swimming in the River Imjin on the sandbanks were too hot to stand on. It was 120, very, very hot, but very cooling to have gone into the River Imjin. That had many stories told about it as regards when the Korean defensive advanced up to and past the 38th parallel. The River Imjin was the scene of quite some battles by United Nations troops. I don't know if it was many British, but certainly Americans were involved. And they slung, I think it was a Bailey Bridge, and they also, the American pioneers, built a wooden bridge, which was absolutely superb. As a carpenter, I looked at the construction of it and admired it, that those pioneers had done a marvellous job. That is bridge building at its best, with the least amount of equipment, I think I would term it there. There were situations when the the land either side of the roads leading to the battlefront was no man's land, although there was no fight and it could be a long way. There were still anti-personnel mines, as there is in many parts of the world today, in agricultural land. And of course, you had without being too politically minded, you had the agricultural south, as you have in Great Britain, and the industrial north, as in Birmingham and the north. And to put a line through the centre of it, you know, was one of those things. Yes, the industrial north of Korea obviously contributes a lot towards the economy of that country and the agricultural, in which we were in that agricultural sector, and there was many farmsteads in that valley in front of me. Some of the farmers were adamant in not giving up their livelihoods. And obviously people in the military did not want those buildings protecting any possible North Korean troops. And I have seen the places set on fire with tracer bullets.